families. It shows rising surpluses and falling debt, with the economy set to grow at 2.8% over the next 5 years. With our books in the black and the economy continuing to grow, we now have choices we simply didn't have 8 years ago. It means we can invest more in health and education and in infrastructure like roads and schools. It means we can support businesses further by investing in innovation, which will not only help diversify the economy, but also supports more jobs and higher incomes for New Zealanders. It also means we can help support vulnerable New Zealanders while starting to reduce debt. We recognise that housing, both affordable and social, remains a challenge, and we're working hard to address that. Around 40 houses are being built every working day in Auckland, four times more than when we came into office. We created 154 special housing areas with the Auckland Council, and we've released land for another 56,000 homes. We've also freed up enough surplus Crown land in Auckland so far for nearly 1,000 homes. 20% of those must be affordable and 20% social housing. We've helped almost 12,000 families nationwide into their first home through the KiwiSaver Homestart grant over the last year. In terms of social housing, we spend $34 million every week to subsidise more than 470,000 New Zealanders in social housing and private rentals. We help 134 tenants and their families into social housing every week, and we're building around 17 new social houses a week. We've also announced in the budget an additional $41 million for emergency housing and grants. So there's plenty going on. We'll soon release a national policy statement on urban development, which will go out for public consultation. It will complement the RMA amendments currently before Parliament that puts new requirements on councils to provide enough housing development to meet demand. The national policy statement is the next step in the government's wider program focused on ensuring councils free up land so houses can be built faster, particularly in areas of high demand. With respect to Auckland, the council will consider its unitary plan options for responding to the housing needs of our largest city in the next few months. I said before, the government's expectations are absolutely clear. We must continue lifting the supply of new houses in Auckland to meet the demands of this growing city. Everyone has a part to play, the government, the council, developers and community organisations. As you may have seen, I'm heading to Fiji next week on an official visit. The visit marks a significant milestone in the renewal of the political and diplomatic relationship between New Zealand and Fiji. It will be the first time in a decade a New Zealand Prime Minister has visited Fiji. I look forward to discussing a wide range of issues with Prime Minister Bainimarama, including Fiji's recovery from Cyclone Winston and the PACER Plus negotiations. Parliament this week will continue the budget debate. We'll also have third readings of the Residential Tenancy Amendment Bill and the Taxation Bill. In terms of my own activities, I'm in Wellington tomorrow and on Wednesday. I'm in Auckland on Thursday and Taranaki King Country on Friday.
Are you worried about New Zealand's reputation in the wake of the Panama Papers, and have you ever met with Jeff Cohn?
Okay, so in terms of the first one, no, I'm not concerned, because I think the government is taking wide-ranging steps to ensure it has the best policies in place, and they include the review that's been undertaken by John Shewan, the work we're doing with the OECD. In terms of Jeff Cohn, I don't think I've formally met him, but I'm pretty sure I've met him at a social event before.
Is it time to roll out the second phase of the AML legislation, I know you have referred to it, but Co-Marshall is not specifically covered by that legislation at the moment, or not on that reporting FC list.
Right, so yes, it is the time to bring in the second phase, and we're working on expediting that, if you like. My understanding on the advice I've had is that Co-Marshall do have a subsidiary which is covered by the AML Part 1 legislation, but whether those transactions are or aren't, I just don't know, because I don't have access to that information.
Isn't it the case that you've had some pushback from lawyers and real estate agents on that phase too, though?
I haven't had advice on the phase 2, you have to ask the Minister of Justice.
Have you looked into whether IRD are going to investigate in terms of Kazakhstan or Malta?
Whether they'll look into those areas, I don't have the advice again, you'd have to ask the Minister of IRD's office.
Doesn't this just show that the system is allowing these structures basically disguise the beneficial owners and where the funds are coming from. And for people, politically exposed people like this convicted ex-prime minister.
Okay, in the first instance, what I'd say is if you think about part one of the AML legislation, that's quite specific in terms of, as I understand it, knowing the client and knowing the source of funds. So the obligations on anyone covered under the Part 1 of the AML legislation are quite far-reaching. What's clear is to cover off all of the other kinds of entities, I think, that might be able to set up these transactions. So they're likely to be, you know, less intensive in this area, although there might be, it just depends. Then we certainly need to pass Part 2 of that, and there's no question that as a result of, you know, the debate around Panama Papers and the sort of wider public debate globally about this issue, we're certainly trying to push Part 2 of that through as quickly as we can.
Does New Zealand have a double tax arrangement with Cabinet Scandal and Malta?
I don't know. Again, you have to ask the office. We may not necessarily have a double tax agreement. You know, sometimes we'll only have a double tax agreement with a country we were very confident about their actual tax system and tax structure themselves, and they might, and they also obviously want to have that, which is why we have a smaller number of double tax agreements as opposed to information sharing agreements. And in some cases, the information sharing agreements for countries is covered under the broader topic of the sort of master agreement that we've got, and I just don't know about those countries. With Malta, I think it's yes, but I just don't know.
Okay, so after the sharing review, do you envisage that the beneficial owner will be visible to IRD?
I just wouldn't want to guess what he might do in that review. I mean, we have huge respect for John Shewan, his capacity to both understand the issues and to understand the wider issue at stake, which is making sure that I think we preserve the good reputation that New Zealand's got. So if, as a result of John Shewan's work, he comes up with some recommendations, I would have thought the government's going to look pretty favourably at those, but what those recommendations might be, I don't know yet.
But isn't it the case that the NGOs involved in this area all say that the only way to solve this problem and restore New Zealand's reputation is to have the beneficial owner disclose to IRD?
Well, I think one point I'd make is I think New Zealand's reputation is in good shape. It doesn't mean that there can't be further enhancements in terms of the policies that we have that will preserve that good reputation. But by any definition, I think we're in pretty good shape. What those recommendations are, again, we just need to wait and see.
Have other cases come out with New Zealand links? For example, corrupt politicians, would you act any more urgently, or do you think that the government's on the right track?
Well, my understanding is we're moving pretty much as quickly as we can. John Shewan's work will be back, I think, with the gym by memory. But obviously, it's a matter of him getting that work done professionally, so, you know, within reason, we'd rather take any of the time we had to. But in terms of the Part 2 AML progress, that's going to happen as rapidly as we practically can. It's, I think, a little more challenging as you go away from the specialist firms, but they're working on that as quickly as they can. And Parliament's already been progressing the issue around proactive disclosure of information to a much greater number of countries than just Australia and the US in terms of factor.
Well, can you guarantee that with the AML Part 2, because it has been a long hold up, mate? I think 2 or 3 weeks ago you said you put an urgent priority on it, and still no movement.
Things don't move instantly, obviously, in government. So they are, you know, when we put a priority on it, we are putting a priority on it, and it is moving very rapidly up the work program for justice, but they've got a very busy program, and so we're having to leapfrog some other things. My understanding is they're working quite aggressively on it now.
So can you guarantee that IRD will investigate these allegations, these international allegations?
Well, what if no one has access to the papers at the moment, only the journalists. So if you want to give those to IRD, then you
the
can
see... The information's out there, though.
Well, the database is out there. I think the sort of papers, as I understand it, are being held back by the investigative journalists outfit.
So what you're saying, with all the information out there in the public through reporting, both in New Zealand and around the world, IRD can't act, they can't have access to the papers?
No, what I'm saying is I don't direct IRD. I mean, these are individual tax matters, but IRD is quite conscious of the issue, and I think some weeks ago when we were talking about it, made it quite clear if they saw anything that they were concerned about, they would go and act on that. Now, I'm having discussions with them today about whether they've seen anything yet that they're concerned about, but if they do, I'm sure they'll go and have a look at it. But in the end, that's sort of in their hands, really.
Even the DIA says that, you know, they have their reporting entities list, but that doesn't guarantee compliance is basically that these things are registered with them.
Is that for AML or is
for
that
AML, for yes, AML?
Well, my understanding, the part one of firms covered by part one of the AML legislation is it's quite onerous on them. So they have to understand their client, they have to understand the source of funds, they have to be confident about that information. They are audited on a 2-yearly basis and the records are opened up. So any company that's covered by the part one of their AML legislation takes their responsibilities very seriously. If they don't, then there are significant repercussions.
I have a quick question on the Navy 75th anniversary.
Yep.
To your knowledge, is the Chinese Navy invited and do they want, are they likely to come?
I'm not sure whether it's formally been announced, but they've certainly been invited and I think it's highly likely they'll come.
Then, given that they obviously have nuclear submarines and whatnot, is that an issue with the Chinese Navy? Are they having to sort of say that they're not going to use a nuclear ship?
Okay, so the anti-nuclear legislation isn't country-specific, it's topic-specific. In other words, you have to meet our law in terms of being either nuclear-powered or nuclear-armed. So any ship that comes at any point, whether it's the celebration of the 75th anniversary of the Navy or at any point, and any aircraft that comes from a military capacity, all of those have to meet our legislation. It doesn't matter whether they're Chinese, American, or from any other part of the world.
Sure, but is the Chinese Navy sort of more open? Are they just happy to say, yes, we confirm New Zealand, this is a non-nuclear ship, as opposed to the United States, you would have seen the ambassador is still saying that they're not going to confirm or deny?
Yeah, so the process is, you know, I think we've been to this before, but the process is I, as Prime Minister, have to sign a waiver of the anti-nuclear legislation, and the waiver is based on the advice I get from the Ministry of Foreign Affairs that the particular vessel or aircraft complies with the New Zealand law. Exactly how they form that advice, you really get to go and ask the Ministry of Foreign Affairs, but every waiver I sign quite a lot of them because it's quite a regular thing, just comes with a form that says we advise you as Prime Minister that you will be complying with the law by signing this waiver and advise us to sign it. So how they form that view, I don't know whether they specifically ask it or whether they just do it through open source intelligence. For instance, we know lots of ships, you know, neither nuclear arms or nuclear carry nuclear weapons. So I don't know exactly whether some countries are more open than others.
Yes, I guess my question is just the sort of the attitude of the United States is kind of like, instead of just, you know, why don't they just say?
Yeah, okay. The Americans, I think, for a long time have had neither confirmed or denied position, but they've also had enough open source intelligence about which particular ships are either nuclear armed or carry nuclear weapons. So I think that's sort of been hidden. I think they've made that clear that submarines, I think, are nuclear capable, and certain vessels like the Coast Guard are not, and that's just part of their open source reporting. So I think it's in the end quite possible for the Americans to send a ship that Foreign Affairs would be quite comfortable in providing advice to me and me signing the waiver, but clearly we need to comply with the law.
So the Americans themselves wouldn't necessarily have to do anything if it's in the open intelligence arena?
As I understand, yeah, the Foreign Affairs can make an assessment in their own right of whether something's nuclear powered or nuclear capable. And I think you guys are, I don't want to say older than me, but shall we say more knowledgeable maybe than me, but I'm pretty sure if the Buchanan came, they knew at the time that Buchanan was neither nuclear armed or nuclear powered. So, you know, at the end of the day, if I'd been Prime Minister back then, and I'm sure they would be able to provide David Lockie at the time the advice that he was ready to sign the way.
But that's the sort of nub of where I'm getting at, Prime Minister, is, you know, you've got this more relaxed attitude to the confirm or deny thing. You're happy to say, look, Google will tell Foreign Affairs that ship is not nuclear armed. I'm happy with that.
Okay,
you don't actually need the American government to back down on this policy, do you?
I don't think it's right to say I'm relaxed.
You're more relaxed on than other prime ministers have been.
No, I'm very cognizant of my responsibilities in meeting the law, but how Foreign Affairs form their view of whether, you know, a ship complies or not is a matter for them. I'm not asking the Americans or expecting the Americans to do anything different. What I would expect, though, is a ship that comes complies with our law.
Are you going to see that the National Party appear to have broken the lock-up rules of the budget?
Oh, the embargo.
Yeah.
Yeah, I mean, the point is, of course, it's the information that's embargoed, not the location. So if you, Katie, were to do a selfie in the lock-up, as long as it wasn't breaking information, I would have thought that's okay. But, yeah, maybe you can make a case that they shouldn't have any photo, but... So you're saying,
I mean, we've always all been under the understanding that you don't transmit anything from a budget lockup.
And it's probably sensible that they don't, but if you just think through, that's the absolutely purest perspective. I'm sure you're right, and we prefer people to stick to the embargo, but it's the information that's embargoed, not the location. I think they just had a picture of inside the lockup,
That also had the Wi-Fi password on it, which theoretically you could have been connected to the network and seen those budget documents if you were in the vicinity.
So that wouldn't be good enough for they shouldn't have that. But, look, I don't know, I haven't seen the photo, but I think, that's the issue there. I think we all understand an embargo.
You should reprimand someone in the National Party for sending out those photos?
Yeah, well, I'm sure they'll cease and desist from taking such graphic scenes or whatever in the future.
Just on the fence, when can we expect the defence white paper?
Soon.
Can we be more specific?
Very soon. So, I don't know if it's this week. It's gone to Cabinet, it's been through Cabinet, so it's pretty soon.
The budget
is
included
a wind down. It could be soon, very soon, pretty soon. Maybe back with you, but tomorrow morning, but it's soon, you know.
The budget had a wind down in funds for the Building Partnerships Capability PAGI mission for next year.
Right.
Does that mean you've made the final decision that you won't keep them on past the 2 years, or can we not read that much into it?
No, because what the budget does is it acts on decisions the government has made, and the decision the government has made is that it's a 2 year mission to Taji. Now, you know, it's not my intention to extend it on the information I have today, but if that was to change, then we have to allocate more funds to that.
From the supply packaging, tobacco, has that been signed off by Cabinet, and where is that?
Hasn't been signed off, but the advice I've been getting has been that we should be able to proceed with that, and without the legal risk that had slowed us up, subject to, on the basis of the back of a number of countries who have been acting on their own right. So I'm not sure how far away it is, but it's getting much closer and we keep progressing.
Prime Minister, your visit to Fiji, why now?
I think it's about the right timing. Look, at the end of the day, I mean, it's ancient history now about New Zealand's concerns of the military coup. Actually, Prime Minister today, then Owen Clark, took the right steps and we endorsed the position that New Zealand had adopted. But we always said once they got to the point of having free and fair elections, we would normalise the relationship. It's an important relationship for us in the Pacific. And so I offered to go to Fiji. I thought it was an important step for us as the kind of bigger partner, if you like, to do that. And also on the back of what's happened, of course, as a result of Cyclone Winston, I think it's important to get up there and see what's happening and the progress our people are making.
You said it's the first time in 10 years, but I can't recall Clark going there.
I think she went as part of the Pacific Forum or another particular sort of multi, it might have been Pacific Games. She went for a particular event like that.
Is the government doing enough for the homeless, given that social agencies and workers are referring some of their clients to an Auckland that I?
Well, if you look at what we did in the budget, you can see there's a lot of funds allocated to that issue. Yeah, I think it depends on where you are in the country, but $200 million more in this area of social housing, the work we've been doing around income-related rents, moving to community housing providers, and the $41 million for emergency support are all important initiatives. We'll continue to monitor the situation, and we'll continue to see whether there's, you know, more that we need to do. And there's always a battle, if you like, for resources, and that includes the support we give to the most vulnerable, and within various different needs of that sector, we're always looking at different areas. But I don't think you can rationally say that we're not doing quite a lot, because we're doing a lot more than and previous governments have done, but we'll keep monitoring that.
Has the government offered any money at all to Tepuria Marae at all for it?
I'm not aware of that.
The homeless?
Yeah, I'm not aware of that. You'd have to ask them.
Well, we don't have a view on whether Auckland's port could be relocated as part of this push to free up more land somewhere else.
No, I haven't taken a view on that. I mean, some years ago, I think they looked at the issue of the Auckland port when Stephen Joyce was Minister of Transport, and I think at the time he took the view, wasn't it? I think a formal sort of investigation, but took the view at the time that it was appropriately placed where it was.
Do you think it should now be up for discussion as part of the sustained build with a large amount of apartments or anything like that?
I think in the first instance, it's really a matter for the Auckland Council, but I think most people would probably say if they were to redevelop the area there, it's at the sort of higher end of housing, because if you look at the other end of where the Auckland Port is, the Viaduct area and down there with Wynyard Quarter, they're certainly doing a lot of building down there, but it's reasonably sort of middle to high income housing.
What assets would you propose they sell to raise funding for infrastructure?
So it's not from the government to decide, you know, the makeup of Auckland Council's balance sheet, but it is appropriate that the Auckland Council looks at its balance sheet and looks at how it might fund the growth needs of Auckland City.
Prime Minister, just back on the plain packaging issue, it's my understanding that it's been with Cabinet for about 3 years. Can you give us an idea of the timeline and why it's taken so long?
No, it's not quite right to say it's been with Cabinet 3 years. What happens is the issue got raised many years ago, you're right about that. At the time, the advice that I was getting was that because they were very uncertain about what would happen as a result of the lawsuit that the major tobacco companies were taking against the Australian government, that the most prudent thing I could do was see how that played out. And in that period of time, what's happened is the world's moved on. There's been quite a number of countries that moved towards plain packaging. And the advice I've been getting from my officials is that it's safer for us to proceed unilaterally. So it goes to Cabinet at some point, and Cabinet makes that decision. I don't think we've made that formal decision yet. There's one other step I think we've got to take. But what I'm saying to you is we're getting much more comfortable moving more quickly towards that decision.
So it'll happen this year?
I can't give you an exact time frame, but we're moving towards that. We're far less concerned than we were about the legal risks that we faced.
The Australian case was settled, Australia won last year. On this case. So, I mean, I'm just wondering why it's taken so long and why you don't think, why you're not confident that it'll happen this year.
Need to check that on the Australian position. I'm sure you're probably right, you know you are, but I'm not 100% sure about that. But anyway, we are moving towards that issue, but it is what it is. Yeah, that was the advice I got, and that was the decision we took.
Has something changed? Because just a couple of months ago, both you and the Minister told me it would definitely be this year.
Yeah, well, I'm sure it will be, but I just don't have a timetable. I haven't seen exactly when it's going to be.
And British Americans back home are still threatening legal action. They say that by any means possible, is that
holding
Canada at all?
No, as I said, what held us up was the advice I had from the officials at the time some years ago was that we faced legal risk, and it seemed like a lot of money for us to potentially spend on a lawsuit when we were a bit uncertain about what was going to happen in Australia and how much risk we actually faced. And so more prudent thing to us seemed to be to wait, and so that's why we did wait. And then in recent times, when we started progressing the issue again, which was keen to progress, the advice to be changed and said we're more, much more confident.
Is it just not a priority then if Cabinet can just do one move and sign it off?
No, I just don't know exact where it's in the pecking order, but I can certainly go and find out where.
On housing, several senior ministers, you may have even said this yourself, have said that it isn't a question of money, it's a question of finding houses available to buy.
Housing?
Well, that's really what I was going to ask you. What are they referring to there? Do they mean emergency housing or social housing or both?
I think you need to look in the context of the particular question they were asked. I remember Bill English saying that. I don't know if other ministers have said it. My memory was that he said that in relation to social housing. I think his argument was it's about getting availability to those particular houses. It wasn't a sort of financial issue. And the government has been doing quite a lot in that space. So if you think about, for instance, both Housing New Zealand Homes and the ones that fit within that social housing criteria, the advice that I've had is that while the overall number of Housing New Zealand Homes hasn't changed dramatically in recent years, the composition of those have changed, and considerably more of them are now in Auckland. I think that's really the point that Bill English was making.
So the government seeking to buy more social housing, is that the point?
Well, I think his main point was the main point holding us back is not financial resources, it's the work that we're doing in that area, and we already are doing that. We are changing that mix, and we have been buying a lot more, as I think I said in my notes. I mean, we're building 17 social houses a week.
Just on that, a quick process issue related to the $5,000 payment.
Oh, yeah.
When did you find out about that from Paul Bennett?
Okay, so exact timing of it, I wasn't aware she was going to do it that particular day, but it was by Cabinet in the early part of this year. So it's been part of the overall sort of view that she, you know, that she held that we could do that. It's a pretty small amount because it's essentially 1,500 people, $750,000, so therefore, you know, it's quite what the delegations, but the early part of the year was consideration given to extending the 3K to Christchurch to a different amount for Auckland.
And when did you find out that you were sort of announced it? Did you know that day, for instance?
I wasn't aware she was going to do it that day, but I was aware at some point she was likely to do it.
So Cabinet signed off on that at the early part of this year?
Well, it's the broader, I think it's around the broader principles of an extension of this kind of financial inducement. Let's go back and actually look at the paperwork.
But you didn't know about it on...
No, she was going to do it that particular day. I think she was going to do it.
Just going back to the second round of AML, have you been approached by anyone in the legal or real estate communities to say this is quite onerous and maybe it's not a good idea?
I can't recall any discussions I've had with people in that regard.
Prime Minister, a quick question about the Fox Glacier helicopter crash. That company has had its license suspended by the CAA. The question is sort of, you know, how does this look for New Zealand tourism? Another tourism-related accident.
Well, it was a great tragedy, and obviously we mourn the loss of the individuals on that particular helicopter that Fox Glacier, you know, lost. I mean, I think at one level what it demonstrates to international tourists and domestic tourists for that, and that they might use as well, is that civil aviation take their responsibilities seriously. So, in so much that there are questions for them to answer, they're obviously investigating those.
Is it appropriate for Sanford to own the video monitoring company for fishing vessels called Trident?
Yeah, I think so. I mean, look, the important point around Trident is that is, as I understand it, both technology and hardware in relation to recording catches on board vessels. And then just because a fishing company, or fishing companies as the case might be, own that went through a competitive tender process. They, as I said, the subsidiary tried to have the best technology and obviously provide the best value for money. It's quite independent. But also all of that information is held by MPI in totality, so they can access it anytime they want, any part of the information. So while trying to provide a summary to MPI because that's convenient, MPI have access to all of the unbroken data anytime they want.
Should try to be part of the wider review that is going on, the investigation, into the investigations?
I don't think so. I mean, I think the issue here isn't whether the technology works or whether the capability is there, because I think that no one seems to be contesting that. They're simply just saying because, you know, a fishing company or fishing companies, you know, have a subsidiary company and somehow, you know, Greenpeace think that they shouldn't be allowed to have that contract. I wouldn't agree with that. Often you get companies that have specialist interests. I mean, what isn't the point I was making this morning, I think, is the right point, which is that the fishing companies themselves have a very strong vested interest that the QMS system works and works properly, because if they don't, in the end what will happen is fish stocks will be depleted and their quota will be reduced, and we've seen that over the past few years in certain areas. They voluntarily reduce their quota. That has quite a big impact on their income. Now, the reason you need the kind of video capability that Trident provides is because within any system, it's possible to have a rotten apple in the barrel. And so to give people confidence, you need the likes of, you know, the video surveillance. You also need the observers on the boats. You need better capability of understanding what everybody's doing. But I don't think if you think through the logics of it, there's any sensible reason why a quota holder would break the rules, because I think in the end it would come to law.
Is there any process in place within the caucus or to do with cabinet members or yourself when you're dealing with Stanford issues and Peter Goodfellow, the president of the National Party.
He is immensely careful about managing any conflict of interest. I've never had a discussion with him about fisheries matters if they're raised at the caucus, because he goes to caucus, he always leaves the room. He's obviously not a member of cabinet, so he doesn't get access to that information. So he treats that conflict of interest very seriously and very professionally.
Just in light of those issues that were raised 2 weeks ago, though, isn't it kind of important to try to investigate it? I mean, it's to regulate it.
The allegations by Greenpeace aren't that the information as a result of Trident is either incorrect or has been altered or doesn't do its job properly. The allegation is just simply a nefarious one that because a number of fishing companies own a particular vehicle, that somehow they're not the best people to be able to be in that role. I mean, I personally don't agree with that. I mean, as long as they've gone through an open competitive tender and been proven to be the best in an arm's length transaction, I think it's okay that they have that ownership.
Do you know of any issues that MPI's had with Trident?
I'm not aware of any, but you'd need to go and ask the minister. It just wouldn't come to my office.
Have you been made aware of something fat about reports in New Zealand that have been killed by a crocodile in Australia?
I saw the media reports, but I didn't need any advice from you.
Okay.
Okay.